Welcome back to the Para Podcast. I'm your host, Sandra, and today I'm super excited because we are back in the studio. I am reunited with Mia, so she is joining us today. We have podcast-themed nails. We also have a new Para Podcast tumbler for my coffee or tea, and we are going to be joined by a special guest today. Her name is Carly. She is the owner of not one, not two, but three macaws and an African gray. So we're going to get chatting with her and get to know her birds. You might know them from Instagram at Shelby the Macaw. Her macaws are Shelby, Tommy, and Loki, and Sammy is her African gray. So we're going to get to know her birds and what life is like with three macaws and an African gray, who is a powder bird. We're going to talk about the strength of the bite force of a macaw, because she talks about this on her Instagram, and it is stronger than a lion's bite. You heard that right. A macaw's bite can be stronger than a lion's bite. We're going to talk about free flight training, the types of weather parrots can be out in, anatomy, and so much more. So let's get chatting with Carly.
Hello.
Hi. Oh, Shelby. Hello.
Hello.
Nice to meet you.
Oh my gosh, you're so excited.
You're so cute. Hello.
Say hello.
I love you. Oh my gosh. Mia, look. It's Shelby.
Oh, look at your tiny little one.
I know. She's like a little nugget compared to them.
Oh, gorgeous though. She's so Thank sweet. You.
Oh my gosh, I love how excited Shelby is. Shelby, you are on the Para Podcast. Welcome. So let's get started, because I'm just so excited to chat with you and get to know your birds. I love that Shelby is literally on your head right now. Does she weigh a lot? Like, is it a lot of weight when she's on your head?
So Shelby's quite light. For a blue and gold, she's quite small. And I used to worry about that all the time. I used to panic, and then I just thought, some birds are big, some are small, and she just is a small bird. So she weighs around 945 grams. So yeah, not, I mean, she's not the heaviest blue and gold. They can go up to sort of two kilos. But still, after a while of, yeah, balancing her on your head, it can be quite heavy.
Yeah, because when Mia's on my head, or even she's on my shoulder, like, I don't even feel her.
I know, I can imagine.
Like, she only weighs like 71 grams. So, oh,
I love the time.
Yeah, when I hear how much a macaw weighs, I'm like, oh my gosh, that is some weight.
Yeah, it is. Well, I just adopted an African gray, and she's 420 grams. And I just cannot believe how small she is. I find it fascinating that she, but because I'm so used to these guys, having yeah. her, she just feels tiny. So, yeah.
Yeah. So then if you held Mia, you'd be like, I don't even feel her.
Where is she?
Yeah. Oh, awesome. Okay, so I know about your flock, but tell everybody who's listening about your flock, the birds in your flock, their species, their names, their ages,
mm-hmm.
and cool. anything else you want to share.
On my head is Shelby. She's a blue and gold macaw, and I got her when she was a baby from a breeder. And that was back when I didn't really know a lot about birds. I just knew I wanted a bird and I was desperate for one. I knew I wanted a macaw, and I'd done so much research. I'd actually started looking at getting birds in about 2010. I was just starting a family, so I delayed that. And then about 4 years ago, the opportunity came along to get Shelby. And so I went to a breeder and got her. And then a year later, I adopted Tommy, who's this macaw here, and she's a military macaw. Shelby hates it when I'm talking.
I've noticed in some of your videos, 3 hours later.
Every time I talk. We got Tommy a year later. She's a military macaw. And then I got Loki a year later, and he is a hybrid macaw. I think one of his parents is a scarlet macaw and the other is a shamrock, which is also a hybrid. It's such a mess. I'm not a massive fan of hybrid macaws. So the shamrock macaw would be a military macaw and a scarlet. Okay. So he's like a second generation hybrid. Gets a bit messy. I'd just say scarlet hybrid.
Here, do you want a treat? What's this?
I've got treats ready for when they get annoying.
I love it.
What's this? Do you want this? Come on in. Here we go. And then I, in December, adopted an African grey called Sammy, and she's 17 years old, and she came from within my family. And so although she sort of lives with me and I'm her, like, adopted mum, her owner is still her owner. He loves her and adores her, and yeah, she'll always be his, but she just lives with me.
Oh, that's so cute. And how old are each of your macaws?
So Shelby, this is Loki.
Shelby. Oh, Loki, did you just have a bath?
Yeah, he just
got out. You're a wet chicken.
I know, look at him. He looks a mess.
I love it.
Who's this? Say hi. Oh, he's very much a ladies' man, so he will love you. So Shelby turns four. Wait, I have to think about this. So Shelby turns four in a couple of weeks. Loki turns four in July. And Tommy turns five in July. And Sammy, the African Grey, is 17 years old, but I don't know her date of birth or anything like that.
Yeah. So, yeah. And I wanted to ask you, a green wing and a scarlet macaw, are those the same, just different names?
No, scarlet macaw's an entirely different species to a green wing macaw, yeah.
Entirely different. Because when you look at pictures, they look very similar.
Yeah, they're super similar. The major difference between a green wing and a scarlet is that scarlets have a big yellow stripe through their wings. Green wings have a green stripe through their wings. And also, scarlet macaws have bald faces. Like, the feathers on their faces are like transparent almost, whereas green wings have bright red stripes all over their faces. So,
okay.
And also, green wings are massive, like huge birds. So...
So the green wings are much bigger than the scarlet macaws.
Yeah. They're the second largest species of macaw.
What's the largest? Oh, I know.
Go on.
The hyacinth.
Yeah.
Did I say that right? I never know how to say some of these words. I'm like, how to say words.
Yeah, the hyacinth macaw is the largest macaw in the macaw world.
But I wanted to know, how did each of your birds come into your life? So we know the African Grey is from a family member who adopted them in December. How did each of your macaws come into your life?
So Shelby, like I said, I got from a breeder. So I'd done no research on the homelessness situation in the UK, especially. So there are hundreds and thousands of birds in rescue centres or in homes that are unwanted and that need homes. And I was so unaware of that. And I just thought I would like a macaw. I'd done research on my breeds, and blue and gold was, I felt the species for me. And so, I went to a breeder for her, and she came home at 3 months. And honestly, it was the biggest mistake I've made in owning birds, was getting her first so young and second from a breeder. The breeder's an ethical breeder. He's not, it's not what he did that was wrong. It was just, I didn't know what I was doing with a baby bird. And I found it tough weaning her, and getting her onto solid food and playing around with diet and stuff. But once I'd learned a lot about birds and I kind of started social media as like a project for me to keep a record of what my birds' lives are like, and it grew a following. And as I grew a following, I became so aware of the need for birds to be, or the need, the many birds that need homes. So I wanted to get Shelby a friend. Did some research about birds that needed homes, and I wanted to get Shelby a friend. So I then found Tommy online and adopted her a whole year later from someone that just had no idea about birds. She was in a really horrible state, like really horrible condition. She'd never flown before. She was in a tiny cage, but she was just disgusting. And I, on the way home, I had to stop and wash my hands because she was just so greasy. Like, where I touched her feathers, my hands were dirty afterwards.
Oh my God.
And she had like bumblefoot, so her feet were like yellow and gross, and just, it was just really horrible. So we got her home, I showered her and just loved her. She's actually turned into just the most perfect bird ever. Please. So she's just such a sweet, sweet bird and I love her. And then Loki, his owner needed him rehoming. She just wasn't getting on with him. Scarlets are very, very difficult breeds to own. I think they're the hardest macaw species to own. They're extremely challenging. Their behavior is really unpredictable. They seem to feel their hormones slightly more than all the other birds, in my experience. So, his owner was really struggling with him. And she sort of reached out and was like, please, can you take him? I want him to go to a really good home. And so I agreed to take him. And he lives up to his name as God of Mischief. He's a nightmare, but I love him. I wouldn't take him.
Wow, that's amazing. And I love that because I know that you started off going to a breeder and over time we learn, you know, when we get into having birds, we start learning about what the pet trade is like, how many birds need homes, what their care requirements are. And I think that this is a really good reminder to anybody that's listening that if you're starting out or you're thinking about starting out or you just got a bird, none of us were perfect parents in the beginning and we didn't know everything that we know now. It's something that like you accumulate all this information and knowledge over time, weeks, months, years. And then you get to this point. And I love that you went and rescued Tommy and Loki. And it seems like they really needed you. And I'm so happy that they ended up with you because they look so happy. And I know that they are so loved and so well taken care of. And I'm on the same page as you. We started off with a breeder. And now that I know more, I definitely want to rescue in the future. But with that, I also wanted to ask you, when you brought your rescues home, Tommy and Loki, how did you introduce them to Shelby? And did you do a quarantine? And how did you make sure that, you know, they were all healthy and they got on well?
So in the bird community, it's as a community, we're all very aware that there are diseases and avian diseases that get passed around and they're really lethal. They can wipe out entire flocks and they're quite serious. So I think as standard in the community, I'm not sure about the rest of the world, but in the UK it's sort of standard that the birds get disease tested. So with Tommy, I brought her home and quarantined her. So she stayed in a different room in her own cage and that's where she stayed until she was disease tested. I took her to the vet within a few days of her coming home to me and she was disease tested for 4 or 5 of the avian diseases. And then once they came back as clear and we knew she was healthy, that's when the introduction to Shelby began. Do you want to come? Come here. Come here. She doesn't know what to do with herself. She's like, why are you talking? So that's when the introduction began. And Shelby is a great bird with other birds. She really is so gentle. She's such a well-socialized bird. She just adores other birds. She's never aggressive, she's never attacked another bird or anything like that. So introducing her to Tommy wasn't a concern for me. And then Tommy also just happens to be, I've really fallen on my feet with my birds. Because Tommy's also super, super gentle. No one will ever convince me otherwise. She is the best bird. People say they don't have favorites, but she is my favorite. she's such a gentle, sweet, calm bird too. And so I think that helped them bond quite quickly. Did you want to go up there? I think I just went straight for it. I just put them both, they've got a large aviary. It's not a cage or anything. It's a big aviary. And I went in straight in once she was came back as healthy and put Shelby and Tommy together. And they just really hit it off on day one. I've never had any problems. And now they're actually bonded to each other. Even though they're both female, but they're just bonded. They preen each other constantly. They're sort of partners. And Loki's the third wheel of the family. So he just sort of sits and watches. And then for Loki, he remained with his owner until all of the disease testing had been done. So she was really, really helpful in that she agreed. She took him to the vet on my behalf and had him disease tested. And then he stayed there until all of those results came back. And then once they came back, I literally the next day got in the car and went and got him. And it was a difficult handover because he was very, very much loved. His owner was and is a lovely person. She stays in touch. She kept him until we knew he was healthy. And then when I brought him home, again, because the ovary is so big, there was sort of no problem with just throwing him right in there with them. Mm-hmm. And that was because I knew Shelby and Tommy's personalities, that they're good with other birds. Obviously, before they sort of slept overnight together, I monitored them around each other. And they just all sort of got on straight away. They just left each other alone. There was no fighting or problems. The problems are starting now because Loki's sort of hitting hormones. And so he's being a bit of a monster to these two. So I don't know if you can tell, like Shelby's tail's a mess because he's a tail biter. So he grabs their tails, and whereas his tail is beautiful because he is the one doing the tail biting. So it, unfortunately, it might have to be that I end up getting a separate ovary for Loki, and separating him just maybe even during just the hormonal times, just because he can be a bit of a bully. But yeah, I mean, 98% of the time, all three of them are really good together. And it just sort of, I think I was lucky that they all just sort of meshed and worked well together. And they obviously all free flies and they fly together beautifully. So I'm quite lucky.
Yeah, I've seen them flying together. They look so majestic and beautiful.
Yeah, amazing.
When Loki is tail biting the other two, what do you do to deal with that situation and get him to stop biting their tails?
He bonded with me. So I don't know if he thinks I'm a bird or he thinks he's a human, but he thinks I'm his partner. So it's whenever I go into the aviary, then he sort of fluffs up and he gets upset because he thinks, well, my partner's in here now and these two birds are in our space. And then he gets sort of aggressive with the others. So what I tend to do is I give him lots of one-on-one time, so it's just him. But really, free flight is the big thing. It helps them expend their energy. They get all of their frustration out because they're flying, they're tired, and tons of enrichment as well to keep them all busy and entertained so that they're not bored or frustrated or too focused in their own heads. They're sort of outside of their heads a bit more and kept busy.
Okay, awesome. Actually, I love that you brought up enrichment and that they need physical and mental stimulation, because I saw something that you did on your Instagram and I haven't seen anybody do this yet. And I was like, this is brilliant. So I've been seeing that there's been a lot of dog toys that are being repurposed as foraging toys for birds. And I actually got Mia the sliding one, the slide and hide. The bugging out one, and she loves it. And I've seen people use snuffle mats, but you got licky mats, and have a hole. So you hung them up and then you put the seed butter and you put coconut butter, and then you were sprinkling seeds and crushed nuts on there. And then you put it in the freezer and you hung it up for them. And I'm like, that is brilliant. Why has nobody done this? And I need to do this. So now I want to buy Mia her own licky mat, because we also have a dog. He has a licky mat and he loves it. But now Mia needs one. Tell me, how did they like the licky mat?
Zoom calling with a friend, and she said that she uses Kongs. The dog toys where you put something inside it, and like rubber dog toy that you stuff peanut butter in or whatever. And so indestructible. And so I was looking at dog toys on Amazon and saw the lick mats, and I thought, why wouldn't that work for a bird? And so I grabbed one each, and then just spread some nut butters and seeds, like saying nuts and stuff, and they perfectly had a hole. I don't even know why they've got a hole in them, but they had a hole in them for me to hang up in the aviary, and they loved it. They at first, birds are weird, they saw it and thought, what is this new thing in my cage, why is it here? But Shelby is, she's a food monster. Anything food, and she's there and in it. And she saw all of the goodies attached to it, and she was straight on it. But the big plus is that they're so easy to clean. So I just, yeah, I mean, dog toys and baby toys, they make such great indestructible toys for birds. So I just thought, why not? And it works, and I absolutely love it. And it's so easy to clean. You just shove it in the dishwasher and that's it. We're done.
Yeah. And I saw that when you put the nut butters, and you can even put pellets, I saw you put in there, or you could probably put like some freeze dried fruits and veggies. And if you don't freeze it, then it does get a little bit messy. I saw Sammy was walking all over it, so he got his feet all covered in nut butter. But I love the idea of freezing it, because then it holds everything into place and they have a great old time.
Yeah, that's it. And it did. It worked. The freezing, I think, made the biggest difference, because if I hadn't, their aviaries and their rooms are warm and heated. So instantly it would have just started dripping off. And within half an hour, it was all dripping, and oh, the mess was crazy. But for that first half an hour, it was just perfect. And yeah, stuck all of their, and it's a great way to even feed their meals. We don't have to put their food in a bowl in front of them. Mm-hmm. There are other ways we can feed their food and feed entire meals to them. We just need to be creative sometimes. In the wild, they wouldn't have a metal bowl attached to their perch, and they wouldn't eat up that. They'd go looking for it. So
yeah, I think that's great. And I love that you bring that up, because there are so many different ways that we can feed our birds and try and like mimic the wild. Yes, they're in captivity, but they do have these natural instincts. So like hiding it in toys, or creating these licky mats, or just doing anything but putting it inside of a bowl. Sometimes I get the egg cartons, and the one I buy them from a parrot store to make sure there's no like bacteria or anything like that on there. And then I'll put stuff in there, and then I'll put crinkled paper on top and toy pieces, so that she has to look for her food. And that's something that they do a lot in the wild. So I love that. Can you share maybe some other ways that you provide mental stimulation and enrichment for your birds?
Yeah, even just now, I wrapped up I got a whole walnut, and you know the cardboard in a tube of toilet roll? I just put a whole walnut inside one of those, crush it around the walnut so it's hidden inside, and I give them the inner tube of the toilet roll. And I do that every day, actually, after they've had a big fly. And it just adds an extra step to them getting to the tree. It's just that extra bit of stimulation. And they get through that so quickly now. I crush the cardboard tube around the nut, and then I wrap hemp rope around that as well and tie it really tight. So then they have to sort of get past the rope, get past the cardboard, and get to the nut. So yeah, I mean, just there's so many different ways of making it sounds horrible, but making life difficult for them, making their food challenging. And I think it's so, so important. It's such a big part of offering them enrichment, but it's also easy. We can all do it. We can all just make it slightly more difficult for them to get to their meals.
Yeah, absolutely. I do the same thing even for our dog. Like when I put, like I get him all these different enrichment toys, and I'll hide treats in there, and like freeze dried like beef or meat, and I'll wrap it in a towel to make it harder for him to get to it. So it's like the same concept. And I think that it's also a little bit different when you have big birds and small birds, because if I did that for Mia, I don't know if she'd be able to unravel that. But I do things like, instead of, you know, the hemp rope, I'll wrap something in like paper or stuff it with crinkle paper, so that she can get to it and pull everything out, because her beak and her size is a lot smaller than a macaw. And if I gave her a whole walnut, she wouldn't be able to open it. But I know that a macaw definitely can.
So you just have to adapt to your bird and their abilities, and even it within a species, like Loki is terrible at foraging and he's terrible at enrichment, so I have to make it slightly easier for him. But these two are really, really good at foraging and enrichment, and so I can make it slightly more challenging for them. So yeah, there's sort of different levels of enrichment to offer birds.
And I think that over time, the more that you offer these foraging opportunities and enrichment for them, practice makes perfect. So they get better and better at it. The first time I offered certain types of enrichment or foraging opportunities for Mia, she was just looking at it like, what is this? Or, you know, she would like slowly get into it. But like, for example, with the slide and hide dog toy, now she's a pro. The first month she was just staring at it. Like, what do you want me to do with this? And now she's sliding everything around, moving it open, trying to get to everything that's in there. So I think that over time, you also get to know your bird and what their level is with these kinds of activities. So I know that a blue and gold's macaw, a blue and gold macaw's bite is very strong because recently we had Mikey and Mia on the podcast and I think you guys know each other.
Yep.
So that's really cool. And we were chatting about what an intense bite it is when you get a bite from one of those macaws. But you also did a post about the intensity and how a macaw's bite is stronger than a lion's bite. And I was like, oh my gosh, that is so crazy. So they can really do a lot of damage. And I also love that you talk about on your page that getting bites from a bird is part of parrot ownership. So tell me a little bit about the bite force. Since you have different types of macaws, different species, do you notice a difference between their bite forces or the way that they bite? And how often do you get bitten?
Yeah. So biting is such a big, obviously, part of owning birds. It's not okay. And everyone in the bird world says this. It's not a case of if you get bitten, it's a case of when. And it's something that you need to be prepared for when you're going into owning birds. It's just, unless you never handle your bird, you are going to get bitten.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, the lion fact is crazy because a greenwing macaw, so it's a greenwing macaw that has a bite force of up to 2000 psi, which is just incredible. And then a lion can be between 600 and 800 psi. So if you think it's like almost double or over double the bite force, but you need to take size into consideration. Like a lion can bite your head off, a macaw can't. But they can break bones, they can go through fingers, they could potentially remove an entire digit from your hand. But it's rare. It's rare that a bird will put all of their power behind a bite because they're prey animals, they're not predators, so they're not built to fight. Their primary source of escaping a threat is to fly away, which is why they have wings. So when you think of the fight or flight response, their primary source of protecting themselves is flight. So biting a threat doesn't come naturally to them. It's just something that it happens in captivity because we're around them and we handle them a lot. And so they sort of learn that biting works. Whereas in the wild, they wouldn't bite each other as much. You do see biting and you see parrots fighting, especially in Australia, you see the cockatoos and stuff. They really fight with each other. And it can happen, but biting isn't their primary source of defending themselves. But the reason behind the strong and intense bite forces so that they can break through tough shells in the wild when they get into their food. As for my three, I don't know. I think Tommy's bite force, the military macaw, if she put all of her power behind it, I think hers would be the worst. And I think that's because her beak is small but powerful, and yet she is still sort of a similar size to the rest of the birds. So I think, but Loki's bite as well is vile. It's horrible. It's so bad. Shelby's bite's just a typical blue and gold. It hurts. And she really could cause some damage, but she's just never done that. I think once she bit me here and I screamed and I thought she was going to go straight through my skin and meet her beak on the other side. And that was the worst bite she's ever given. But I think Tommy, if she did, would be the worst.
Have they ever bitten you where they broke skin? I know you've been showing that you've gotten bruises.
Yeah, I mean, I'm covered in bruises right now. I've got like a massive bruise here. Massive bruise here from, these are all from Loki. Because again, because he sees me as a partner. I know, the monster of the family. He constantly is just pinching me for attention. It's a really horrible habit that he's got into. But the worst fight I've ever had, and she'll probably be watching this and be like, you've called me out again. But my friend has a green wing, and he bit me on my hand. It broke the skin, but I genuinely thought I was going to break my entire hand. And I've got a permanent scar, so I'll have this to remind me of him for the rest of my life. But
a green wing tattoo.
Yeah, man. And I've never cried from an injury from a bird. Like I've got quite a high pain threshold, and I burst into tears because it was so bad. I really honestly thought all of these bones in the back of my hand were going to be broken and splintered. I thought I'd need the hospital, but yeah, I mean, that was the worst. And the green wings are the ones with the most powerful bite, so they, out of all of the species of macaws, they are the ones that I'm really wary of. And one of my very good friends has two green wings, and I was with him the other day, and I picked one of them up, and she sort of went to mouth my hand. I was like, no, you won't. And put her back down again. Because I thought, I'm not being there again. I'm not going back there.
Oh my gosh. That is so intense. I can't even imagine the pain.
Oh, it's just so bad. But the small guys bite bad too. Like, their bites are, they go through the skin, and people underestimate how bad they are.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. They all bite. They all bite. Mia also bites me every now and then. Like you said, it's just a matter of time when you have a bird, you know. Every so often something sets her off. Lately, she hates my phone. So sometimes I'll take pictures and videos of her and she's totally fine. Other times I'll pick up my phone to reply to a message and she is coming at my fingers because they are holding the phone. And I'm like, what?
What did it do?
But that's so weird. At least she won't like destroy my phone, because even if she hates my phone and she goes to bite it, she's not going to ruin my iPhone. But I know that a macaw can break your phone, and then you need to replace that.
Yeah.
Have you ever had your phone?
Not my phone, thankfully, but my, I have a laptop. Well, I had a laptop. It is no longer because it's destroyed. Shelby pulled all the keys out of my MacBook. And I don't know if you can see, my blinds are destroyed from Shelby. That is one thing that I think people don't realize. When you get a bird, they're expensive, but it's also the stuff you're replacing and the things that they break that you're having to rebuy. And like you say, phones, a friend of mine's gone through about 5 TVs. I've gone through a TV because Shelby bit through it. So, I mean, all of those things alone, without even the bird, are
Those are expensive things, like big flat screen TVs, iPhones. Like, they don't cost a couple of dollars. They cost a couple of thousand of dollars. So, yeah, birds come with a lot of different behaviors, and there's a lot of things to think about and consider when you're bringing birds into your home. But I wanted to go back to the biting, because I wanted to, for anybody who's listening, to understand the PSI and how strong different birds' bites are. So in one of your posts, you mentioned that budgies, they have a bite force of around 30 to 40 pounds per square inch, which is the PSI. And then Amazon parrots, such as the blue-fronted Amazon, have a stronger bite force of 200 to 400 PSI. And then the African gray has a bite force of approximately 500 PSI. And then we get to the macaw, who can have a bite force of up to 2000 PSI. So even the little guys, they have a strong bite force. Like Mia, when she bites me, she doesn't always break skin. I actually don't think she's ever broken my skin. I guess she's really sweet that way. Thank you, Mia. But at the same time, she could if she wanted to. And the bigger the bird, the stronger the bite. So for anybody who is listening, do you have any tips or advice if someone is dealing with biting? Because I know that this is something that people commonly struggle with, especially when they're new to having birds. For example, I had somebody who messaged me and said, "Hi, I have a son, Conyer. He was 6 weeks old when we got him, and he has bonded with my son. And if someone else in my family tries to get close to me, he tries to attack that other person. But if he can't attack the other person, he attacks me. What can I do about that? And how can I redirect him to stop that behavior?"
It's definitely something that I think, so like 90% of people will face the issue of biting at some point in their parrot ownership. It is just a part of owning birds, but there are ways to deal with it. I always say, so I did tons of research before I got my birds into the way their minds work and behavior and all sorts of psychological research onto what causes certain behaviors and how to sort of distract away from those behaviors and discourage them. And I think the main thing that people need to realize is that punishment doesn't work, and actually it makes things a lot worse. And yeah, distraction and positive reinforcement really is the way forward. So I tell you one thing, I think target training and clicker training are the difference between a badly behaved bird and an impeccably behaved bird. And target training is a simple chopstick, and your bird is encouraged to just touch the tip of the chopstick and using a clicker to mark the moment that they do that and offer some sort of positive reinforcement for that behavior. It's a trick that most birds will pick up within a couple of minutes. They quickly learn that, oh, every time I touch the end of this stick, I get a reward. It encourages them to positively use their beak in a way that they get a reward for. So we're not encouraging them to bite the tip of the chopstick. We're encouraging them just to touch it with the very tip of their tongue or the outside of their beak. And the way you do that is just you hold it just far enough away from them that they sort of have to reach for it instead of holding it right in their face where they're like, bite, get it out of my face sort of thing. This is quite in depth. I could go on forever about training. I love training. I love sort of the behavior of birds and nitpicking and picking away at why birds do certain things. But I firmly believe that target training and clicker training is so, so good for redirecting certain behaviors and encouraging other behaviors. So I think, yeah, implementing a strict routine, distraction, lots of enrichment, of course, keeping the bird busy. But also when it comes to birds having a favorite person, and a person that lives with them that isn't their favorite person, you do find that the bird will attack the person that isn't the favorite. I always find that encouraging people to share out responsibilities can help with that. So the person that the bird likes slightly less may get to do all of the things that the bird really enjoys. So meal times, giving them their food. If the bird really loves a shower, then that person that the bird doesn't like as much does the showering. That person the bird doesn't like as much can get involved with the training, because training equals treats. So yeah, I mean, there's lots and lots of ways around it. It's really hard to go into the nooks and crannies of training here, but there's, yeah, I mean, positive reinforcement for one, and never discipline your bird, because it really just does make things so much worse.
Yeah. I've talked about, I did actually a whole podcast episode about how punishment doesn't work. And like you said, it just makes things worse. And the way that birds are wired, like, they don't respond to punishment at all. When it comes to biting as well, like, there are so many reasons that birds bite. And I think that if someone's bird is biting, you need to really figure out why your bird is biting, what's happening in that moment, what happened right before the bite, and try and narrow down and figure out what is causing your bird to bite, and then work from there. And I always think that it's a good idea to even, like, film interactions or keep a journal, so you can kind of keep track of, like, what is happening before, why the bite happened, and what happens after.
That's such a good point, because yeah, bites, they're always caused by something. The bites aren't random. They're not spontaneous. They're
not malicious.
Yeah, that's it. And yeah, birds aren't, they're not out to get you. They're not out to hurt you, but there is something behind the bite. There is a cause behind the bite. And yeah, getting to the bottom of that is key.
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to ask you, how do you handle behavioral challenges when you are training with your macaws?
Again, it's just a case of positive reinforcement. So I really hyper focus on the things they are doing right, and really work out and really reinforce those behaviors. And negative behaviors, I tend to ignore, walk away from, turn my back on, focus my energy elsewhere, just to distract away from that negative energy, or that negative behavior.
Yeah.
And I think also it's really important. I think everything always comes back down to diet, and I think diet plays a big, big part. And bad behaviors and negative behaviors, it's really hard to point those out if the positives aren't being reinforced adequately. So if a bird performs a positive behavior, for example, steps up onto your hand and does it perfectly, doesn't, no beak first bites or anything like that, they step up. If you're rewarding that bird with something that they don't deem as very incentivizing, then it's not going to work. It's they're not going to keep repeating that behavior if what they're getting in return isn't highly valuable to them. So
Yeah.
finding a way of using a high value reward in return or in exchange for a good behavior is really important. And most of the time that's a type of food, but it doesn't always have to be. Sometimes a person is highly valuable. And so, for example, when I started training my African Grey, Sammy, I'd step her up and she's just not interested in food at all. So I was trying to work out what can I give her that reinforces that positive behavior. And actually putting her back on the perch and stepping back was valuable to her because she just didn't want to be stepping up. So she knew that if she stepped up onto my hand, I'd only keep her there for a second before putting her back. So she just thinks, I'll step onto the hand because eventually she'll put me down again. And that's what I want. I want you to step back away from me.
Yeah.
And that was more valuable to her than offering her any food. And now she steps up beautifully. And she's actually happy in my presence because she knows I'm not going to force her to stay with me or do anything she doesn't want to do.
Yeah.
So.
I love that. And I also noticed when I was watching your videos that you free flight train your parrots. And when they're free flying, that's when they get nuts. So when you're doing training, like target training or other types of training at home, what other types of positive reinforcement or rewards do you offer them other than nuts? Because I know nuts and seeds are the most popular, but when you free fly, you reserve those nuts, those high values for when you're outdoors.
Yeah, I mean, in the home, if we're doing training at home, I'll still use nuts in the home, because they always associate those with training and good behavior. But I also use pieces of fruit, small pieces of fruit. And again, just offering them, it might even be a behavior or an action from me that I know that they're after. So for example, Loki spending time on me is a positive experience for him. So if he's done really well or he's got a really good behavior, then I'll really focus some energy and attention on him, because I know that's what he wants. So Loki's got a really terrible habit of pinching for my attention. So he'll pinch around my neck and my face when he wants my attention. And
I
what I've
saw that he
started
pinched
doing,
your nipple once.
oh my God, it's so
Was
bad.
like, when I saw that, I was like, oh my gosh, that must have been so painful.
Oh man, of all the
You're
places.
like, TMI.
Sorry about this,
Like,
everyone,
I love
but
it.
oh God, why? Of all the places, that wasn't a pleasant experience. But yeah, I mean, he's got this pinching problem. And it's attention. See, he doesn't want to hurt me, but he just wants my attention. So what he does is he climbs onto my shoulder and pinches me for attention. And what I've started doing is, for a start, I now no longer let him just walk onto my shoulder because I know it's coming. So as soon as he starts walking towards me, or what he does, walk along the back of the sofa to get to me, I'll sort of move back so that he can't get onto my shoulder. And then I'll offer him the attention he wants from a bit of a distance so that he can't get to me. And then eventually I'll let him come closer, and he's starting to learn that every time he pinches me, I take him off and I move him away because him being near me is the reward, and me giving him attention is the reward. So in that case, food it's a non starter. It doesn't work. And also I don't carry treats around me 24/7, yet every interaction, and this is something bird tricks say, every interaction you have with your bird is a training session. And that's always really stuck with me. Everything you do, every time you play with or spend time with your birds, you're teaching them to do something more or to stop doing something. And sometimes inadvertently, we train our birds to do things that we don't want them to do. And every time Loki was stepping onto my shoulder and pinching me, I was going, okay, okay, and stroking him. And I taught him over time that pinch means stroke. And then I realized what I'm doing. So now if a pinch comes, he immediately gets off me. He moves away, I move away. And it has almost come to a complete stop now.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Yeah, I love that because you're right. Like every time we're having interactions with our birds, we're teaching them something, whether it's if you do this, the result will be this. And so they learn that way. I actually had somebody that had reached out and asked how to stop shoulder rushing. So I know when Loki is on your shoulder, he was pinching you. So you'd have to remove him and you weren't giving him, you know, those scritches because then he knew that if I pinch you, I'm going to get love. So if somebody is has a bird that's shoulder rushing, what would be your advice to stop the shoulder rushing or stopping them? Because I can have Mia on my shoulder. She's totally fine. She'll nap, she'll hang out. She doesn't, she's just like totally calm. She's been napping this whole time. She always does this. So I don't have a problem with Mia being on my shoulder because she's really chill. But some people have this issue where their birds are always shoulder rushing or, you know, they're biting and wanting more attention. So what would be your advice?
So the way with shoulder rushing, first of all, I never let my birds on my head or shoulder unless they will come off 100% of the time when I ask them to. And Shelby, even if I get her to step up, she'll always come off if I ask her to. And if she didn't, if she refused or bit me, if I tried to get her off, then being on the head is no longer a privilege. She's not allowed there anymore. So this is almost a behavior that she's allowed because she's respectful in that she comes off when I ask her to. For shoulder rushing, it's super hard, but my main thing is start step up training straight away and really work on the basics. And people think, oh, I don't want to just step up train. It's too simple. It's too easy. But it forms such a solid foundation for the rest of your training. And if you think holding your bird is the main way that we transport them, move them around, get them from place to place, and being able to do that securely and confidently is best. And so step up training onto the hand and being able to hold the foot securely, not squeeze or hurt them in any way, but hold the foot securely enough that they know that that's where they're staying, they can't get anywhere else, is really, really important. And that in itself can take time. It might even be that you step the bird up, they come on the hand and you just touch, let go and reward, because some birds really don't like their feet being held. Again, Loki is one for that. He doesn't like his feet being held, or he never used to. He's really good now. But yeah, and there's also a way, if you sort of V-hold, so when people hold their birds, they tend to keep their arm really straight, which provides a really nice, easy way of getting up the arm. Whereas if you hold them in this V, it's really hard for them to get from the hand to the shoulder. As long as there's sort of a distance here and they're not just reaching over, and poor this size could reach over and just jump, but smaller birds, make it more difficult, V arm shape to prevent them sort of that nice, easy straight line straight to the shoulder. Really basic training, just step up, put them straight back down again, no holding them for too long, and just start really, really easy basics.
Yeah, really great tips. And while we're on this topic, I also wanted to touch on, because I think that there is a handful of people that also don't realize that if your bird is perched up and hanging out on your head, that is okay. Some people think that their birds are trying to be dominant or something like that, but it's actually not that they're trying to be dominant. Birds just always perch at the highest point. And so if they're perched on top of your head, it's totally okay. As long as they're, like you said, they're being respectful and you have that relationship and training with them.
I totally agree. And so I actually work for the World Parrot Trust as well. And there's a great article on the World Parrot Trust website about that. about does them being on your head or up high mean that they're trying to dominate you? And that isn't how birds work. That's a mammalian thing. It's sort of a predator behavior. It's what predators do in big groups, but it isn't how birds in flocks work because they're prey animals. So the whole point of them being high is that they've got a good view of potential threats around them. So yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah. Okay, I love it. I wanted to go back and focus a little bit on Sammy because we've been talking about macaws. You are actually the first person on the podcast who has an African gray. So tell me a little bit about what it's like to have an African gray. I also know that they're powder birds, so they're a lot more dustier. And I know you have an air purifier that you clean and change the filter regularly. And with birds, we need to have air purifiers. We need to be mindful of our air. And there's powder birds and non-powder birds. And with powder birds, people can have a lot more allergies and reactions to the powder. So tell me about life with an African gray. And does Sammy speak? I want to know because I know that African grays are also really well known for their talking abilities.
Did you want me to go and get her?
If you'd like, why not? Yeah. Does she get along well with the macaws?
They've never met.
Oh!
This is Sammy.
Hi! Sammy! Hello!
Oh my gosh! Hey, hi!
An African gray is like my husband's dream bird. He loves the red tail. Their like talking abilities.
They are crazy, crazy talkers. It's weird because I've never had an interest in African greys. I never wanted one. She sort of stumbled into my life.
It just kind of happened.
Yeah, almost like against my will. I never wanted any more birds after the three big ones. But I sort of couldn't say no. She's so sweet and she's a good bird, aren't you?
Hi, Sammy.
She's 17 years old and she plucks, so she's got bad plucking habit, but what are you saying? Good girl. So, what was the question about Sammy? I forgot.
Oh, okay. Well, the first question, Mia. The first question was, what is life like with an African gray, especially with an African gray being a powder bird?
Yeah, so, God. You know, the difference I noticed in dust with her and the other three is insane.
Really?
I can have my three birds in here for an hour and then her in here for an hour and she will produce more than the three together. And it's just, it's crazy. Like I've got my air purifier next to me and it's constantly like working at max level because when she walks in the room, it detects automatically all of that extra dust. And just to make it clear why they're dusty, so macaws have a gland at the base of their tail that produces oil, and it's also what gives them that delicious smell. And they use that oil.
Oh, is that what it is? I'm always like, why
yeah, I know.
Why so good.
Everyone just sniffs their birds. But yeah, it's the oil that smells, and it smells so delicious. And they cover themselves in that oil. It helps protect the feathers. Keeps them in good quality, keeps them stuck together. Whereas African greys are dust, so they sort of produce a dust over their bodies that they use to protect their feathers. That's because they come from drier climates, but they come from Africa. The dust, the level of dust that she produces is substantially worse than the sort of general dust that the three big guys produce. But other than that, she's just the sweetest bird. I didn't know a huge amount about African greys before I got her. It's definitely a learning curve. I'm still trying to understand her, African greys in general. They're quite complex birds. I always say, like, one of the most difficult birds you can own.
African greys.
Yeah, just because they're so intelligent.
Yeah.
And they just, they can so easily learn things that you can inadvertently teach them things you don't want them to know, behaviors that you don't want them to have. Like when I first brought her home, my son showed a tiny bit of fear when he went to touch her, and she saw that and thought, well, you're a wuss. And now every time he comes near her, she attacks him, or she tries to bite him, because he showed fear that one time, whereas I was quite confident. I sort of handled her quite confidently straight away.
Yeah.
And she sort of picked up that I mean, biting me is not really going to work. So she's never bitten me, but she's bit my son quite badly. And African grey bites are so mean.
So oh, really? Bad. Yeah. What are the African grey bites compared to a macaw's bite?
African greys seem to just slide through the skin like butter. They just go straight in. It's like a paper cut, but super deep. It's really horrible.
Oh my gosh.
And she did. Yeah, she did to my son, just sort of went straight through his thumb. So I wouldn't want to be bitten by her particularly. But whereas macaws are like, it's like having your hands slammed in a door. It's just a bruise. Whereas, yeah.
If you had to choose an African grey bite or a macaw bite, what would you choose?
Oh, God. Neither. No bites.
No bites, please.
Not today.
I saw that you did a post, and actually Sammy was featured, and you said, or the caption was, the worst thing about owning parrots? Well, one of the more difficult aspects of parrot ownership is the dust and mess. The dust can cause allergies and long-term chronic lung issues, such as farrier's lung. Air purifiers are a must for parrot owners. So we chatted a little bit about that, but I wanted to also cover that if someone has allergies or asthma or anything chronic with their lungs, if you're thinking about getting a parrot, look into non-powder birds, because if you get a powder bird, I think it's just like inevitable that over time you're going to need to rehome, because I hear this a lot and I've seen it a lot where African greys end up getting rehomed. And the number one reason that I've seen personally is because the owner was just having too much asthma or allergies and issues with breathing because of how much dust and powder they produce. And I mean, you mentioned it, one African grey produces more powder and dust than three macaws. Like, that's a lot.
It's a lot, isn't it? It's crazy. And yeah. I knew she was a powder bird. I knew African greys were powdery, the same as cockatoos, cockatiels. But I think I underestimated how much. Like, when she leaves the room, I have to hoover every cushion and surface on my sofa and floor.
Can
every
you, like,
time
see it everywhere?
I mean, even now it's just like white powder on, it's like dandruff on everything.
That's crazy. And yeah. I mean, if she's on you or flapping their wings, then you're breathing it in whether you want to or you don't. You can sometimes you can't even see it, like when it's in the air, you know. Yeah,
you can definitely. Where I've recently been ill, so I've recently had this weird cough that I've had for so long. And when she was in the room, within minutes, I'd feel that sort of burning sensation in my lungs, because it's just irritating my lungs instantly. Thankfully, none of us have any allergies related to the dust. But when we're sick or ill, then yeah, you really feel the difference in air quality when she's around.
Yeah. So when you are sick or ill, thankfully you don't have allergies or asthma or anything like that in the family at home. Do you just have her like in a separate room and like handle her less during that time?
I didn't actually. What I did was put the air purifier on stronger. Yeah. No, I wouldn't wear a mask. But I think that's me. That's a preference. I sort of just powered on through, and I kept her out as much as I would have anyway. But yeah, I felt the difference. And what I did actually do was steamed a bit more myself. Like, I had a super hot shower to re-moisturize my lungs.
Oh yeah. Good idea.
Yeah, because it is crazy. It's yeah, they're very dusty, aren't you?
Sammy, you're so cute.
He's so sweet.
I also wanted to mention, because there was another thing that you had mentioned in another post about also the worst things about having parents. And the thing is I love that you share this stuff because it's honest and it's real. And a lot of people don't always realize what they're getting themselves into when they're getting birds. And so we're here to spread that awareness. And you mentioned that you probably shouldn't own a parrot if you don't want an animal that can fly or that screams so loud it can damage your hearing, or you don't want an animal that poops every 15 minutes, or if you don't want to be cleaning for the rest of your life. And those are all true things. Whether you have a powder or non-powder bird, you're going to be cleaning every day. There's going to be poops everywhere all of the time. They are loud and they do fly.
I do feel bad sometimes making that content, but I think with such a large audience, there is some sort of responsibility, and you do have to show the bad with the good. And thankfully, that is something that the majority of those that have big platforms, they do that. There isn't anyone that sort of glorifies it too heavily. So I think as time goes on, more and more people are becoming aware of the difficulties with caring for parrots. This little burrito.
She loves this. She just climbed down into my hand and I was like, okay, well, here we are. This is her favorite. Sometimes she naps like this.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Could you like imagine holding a macaw like this? Like your hand isn't big enough. Yeah.
My hands, especially, I've got the tiniest hands. I'd never be able to do it. I think the community as a whole, those with social media, are doing such a great job with this. And as information and knowledge becomes more accessible, people can just jump onto TikTok and learn how to look after a bird. The more that us as a community are sharing the highs and lows, the better. And I think people are making better decisions when it comes to getting birds. That I feel like there are less people doing it spontaneously, and I think that is thanks to those with the platforms that and they're doing a great job in sharing that information. Yeah.
And I think that on top of that, also more people are starting to go the route of like adopting or rescuing or rehoming, because it is a huge problem. And the parrot trade is a huge problem too. And because there is this demand for these beautiful, intelligent, colorful birds as pets, people have been going out into the jungle and trapping them and taking them from their homes and their natural habitat. And that is just heartbreaking. And that's why, you know, some of these species are also going extinct or, you know, on the brink of extinction because people are trapping them. And then when they capture them, they're not held in great conditions. They're not treated well. And it's just so heartbreaking. So if we can stop that demand in any way, and if by talking about it, we're helping that in any way, right, Mia? You're telling everybody, right? Taking the birds Go from the Mia. Jungle. then I think that the more people that end up rescuing and adopting and rehoming instead of going the route of breeders, which creates demand, then we can help address that issue, hopefully, in the future.
Absolutely. And I think, so where I work for the World Parrot Trust, I see firsthand how bad it is out there, and how bad the wild trade is, and how even though we think it's no big deal just getting a bird from a pet shop or whatever, but actually it's having such a big effect on wild populations, and some of the states in which these birds are caught and transported it's nothing short of a horror story. I mean, these birds are being transported in water bottles.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, I've seen them in plastic water bottles, and I'm like, how can anybody do that? Like, how can you treat another soul or an animal that way? Like, it just makes me feel so sick.
Like you say, for a human being to push a bird into a water bottle and think that is, and not have a tiny bit of your soul feel horrendous for that. I mean, how are these people existing without?
Yeah, I know. It's just, it's awful. And the thing is I also think that birds became such wanted pets. And this started happening hundreds of years ago because they're colorful, because they're smart, because they have talking abilities, because they mimic, and they're so cute. But, you know, their intelligence is also something that I want to touch on, because they are so smart. Like, they deserve so much more. And when they're held in captivity, you know, there's all kinds of behaviors that start to happen. You don't see plucking in the wild. Mm-mm. It happens in captivity because they're distressed. They're not happy. They're mm-hmm. not enriched and all these different things. And, you know, when they started bringing parrots into their homes, they didn't understand hundreds of years ago, you're bringing the wild into your home. This is not natural for them. And it's not a natural pet for us to have.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The process of domestication takes thousands of years. Dogs have been domesticated for thousands of years. Birds have been in captivity for hundreds of years. We're so, so far away from domesticating them. Yeah. And that is the major thing people need to realize, is that they are wild animals. You're bringing a wild animal into a brick building and expecting it to behave a certain way, or behave like your dog and sit quietly and not make a noise. Or you're going to get these animals, they're meant to be in the jungle or in the deserts. They're meant to be screaming miles to each other. They're meant to be destroying things to find food. And it's so important that people realize that they're non-domesticated wild animals. They take specialist care. They need specialist knowledge and understanding. They require specialist vets. Like, nothing about them is just normal.
And because they need specialist vets, those vets are also expensive.
Oh my God. One visit because minor things so much.
Vets that go to vet school, they have to then go take another course or to specialize in avian vet. Mm-hmm. And so avian vets are a lot more expensive than regular vets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that that's something that sometimes people don't realize as well, is the costs that come with owning a parrot, not just the beginning or just getting the bird, but then the continued costs, especially if something happens, if there's an accident, if they fall ill or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. And they live forever. So you've got these vet cats like 60 years. It's not like 10 years like a dog. It's forever.
Yeah. Sometimes they outlive their owners. So you also have to think about, you know, when you have like a macaw, like they can live up to what? 60, 70, 80 years.
Yeah.
And you have to think about a plan for them if they outlive you. Like, you have to have something in place to ensure that they're cared for in case you're not here one day. Because that's just the reality of life.
Yeah. It's just, nothing about them and owning them is simple. There's so many things to think about and so many things to consider. And unfortunately, for the generations that have owned birds, there has been that lack of understanding, and people have brought them into their homes as decorative items. Oh my God, I've got this pet that can talk. And then a year later, they're like, oh my God, I've got this pet that doesn't stop talking, and it makes so much noise, and it's going to live forever. What do? I can't do this forever. It's so challenging.
I think that's why parrots are the number one most rehomed pets around the world, is because of all these things. And that's why we're out here just trying to spread awareness and information on our social media platforms and through the podcast as well. And I wanted to go back to their intelligence level, because I know that the intelligence of a parrot, and I want to talk about African greys. I think with African greys, I read that they have the intelligence of a 3 to 5 year old. That's a child in kindergarten.
Yeah.
You know, I used to be a kindergarten teacher, so they are smart, you know. Yeah. They learn to read, they learn to write, they can speak, you know, full sentences, and like understand so many different things and tasks. Yeah. And parrots have that same intelligence level. So that says a lot about them and what kind of care requirements they need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the high intelligence, they're the things that have really, really attracted me to bird keeping, is the fact that they live so long and their high intelligence. Those are the two things that make birds super challenging to keep, and which is why it's so important for people to understand the highs and lows of looking after birds, because it's the fact that they live forever. This isn't just something that is going to live in your life for a little while. This is something that's going to be here for the long term. And their intelligence levels, that when they're kept in poor conditions, fed horrible diets, and left alone for days on end with no enrichment, they're so aware of that. They know that they're not happy. They get depressed, they get anxious, they get and they understand words in context. Like Sammy, when she's not happy and when she doesn't want to be somewhere, she goes bye-bye, bye-bye, because she constantly wants to move and leave wherever she is.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, like they understand so much, and it makes me so sad. These people that neglect their birds' needs, which are, they are complex, and it is hard for us. We're still learning. We're still trying to understand what they need. Scientists out on the field are still trying to work out what they eat, because we still don't know the full extent of their entire diet. We're playing it by ear. We're seeing what works. We're seeing what doesn't. And yeah, I mean, little mistakes that we can make in our care really does affect them mentally.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that that's why the research aspect of getting a parrot is so important, and really learning as much as you possibly can about like their behaviors, what their needs are, what their cage requirements are, mental stimulation, enrichment, exercise, and all those different things. While we're talking about intelligence, you did a really interesting post that I loved, talking about the intelligence of birds and how they have the cognitive capacity of a small child. And you talked about a parrot's brain and the different functions and how their brains are a lot bigger than we think they are. So tell us a little bit about a parrot's brain.
So parrot brains are really large in comparison to the size of their bodies. And we know through research and understanding in the natural world that the larger the brain, the larger the capacity to learn and understand, the more complex their cognitive abilities are. And so, the actual physical structure of a parrot's brain is super interesting. And don't quote me too heavily on this. I'm not like a scientist. I don't know. I've only just done basic research on these things. But they're very, very dense. The neurons in the bird's brain are really, really dense and intricate, much like a human brain or like a dolphin brain. So, and that tells us so much about their ability to understand, their ability to problem solve. They're excellent problem solvers. And that's why enrichment is so important, because their brains are built to solve problems. And if we're not providing them with a challenging enough environment, like a child, you wouldn't put a child in an empty room and expect it to thrive.
Yeah. You give them Lego, you give them puzzles, you give them books.
Yeah. And they go to school and they learn, because for the first 18 years of a child's life, the brain is developing at such a rate that they need to be constantly stimulated. And it's no different for birds. Just because they're small and a bird doesn't mean that they don't need just as much stimulation.
Absolutely. I love that. Because they are super smart. Now, because they are super smart and they need all that enrichment and mental stimulation, sometimes if they get bored, they get distressed and all these different things, they can start plucking. And I know, actually, from our previous episode with Mikey and Mia, we talked about how their bird dad had mentioned that plucking is a disease of captivity. And I loved that line, because it's true. We talked about this earlier, and we don't see this in the wild. We don't see birds plucking their feathers or plucking each other in the wild. And you mentioned that Sammy has a plucking problem. And I also saw on your page that, I know that this is really frustrating for you, and you've done everything that you possibly can with Shelby, but Shelby still has plucking, and she has some spots that she's missing those feathers. Yeah. So talk to us a little bit about like what that's like as a parent and having to deal with plucking, and how you kind of navigate that to help your bird as much as possible, especially if someone's listening and they have a bird who's plucking.
Yeah. Plucking again, one of those things that so many people will deal with and face. So many people have birds that pluck, and it is a disease of captivity. What? It is something that only happens in captivity that we're aware of. There's been no recorded instances of birds that willingly pull their feathers out in the wild. And I think as an owner of a bird, knowing that, it's the most heartbreaking thing in the world, because you know that something in your bird's life is causing that behavior. And they are self-harming, they're self-mutilating. And so for me, it's been just the worst. It's been such a difficult journey. Shelby started plucking when she was about 7 months old. And I really do hold myself accountable in the fact that I got her too young. I wasn't fully aware of weaning or feeding a baby bird. And that is entirely my fault. So I think that could be partly the cause to Shelby's plucking. But I've spent thousands of pounds on her vet care, trying to get some sort of understanding behind why she's doing it. We're still drawing blanks. I have no idea why. She plucks mostly around her... Oops. Did you say oops? She plucks mostly around her neck and around her hips. But yeah, she's been to the vet. She's been... I've tried different behavioural and training techniques. I've tried... the reason we got Tommy was because I thought maybe she's lonely. So I got her her own bird. And nothing seems to have worked. So to anyone else that's dealing with it, I always, always recommend seeing a vet first, because if you can sort of cross off physical illness or injury first, then that sort of leaves the environment as your next step. And adjust things in the environment. And it can be so simple, like African greys especially, you can add a new toy to their environment and then they can start ripping their feathers out. But you would never think it's that toy. You're just swapping toys in and out and changing things around. And it's really hard to pinpoint exactly what you might have done or not done in your bird's environment. It's the most complex, complex thing. And what's even more frustrating is there's so little understanding behind plucking that insurance companies don't pay out if your bird's plucking, because it's a behavioural problem, and you just, it just drives me insane. So it ends up costing a fortune trying to work out why the bird is doing what they're doing.
Yeah. And have you found that diet has helped or improved the plucking?
I mean, it's not really made a massive difference either way. I've cut out feeding things like freeze-dried fruit, veg, herbs and spices and things, because there's so many ingredients in that particular diet that I wanted to make sure that it wasn't any one of those many, many ingredients that can be found in like a dry mix. So I stopped feeding that. It's made no difference whatsoever. So we're back to just feeding the standard diet, the normal diet she gets. It's a very varied diet. She eats lots of really good stuff, really healthy food. I found that pine nuts did make it worse slightly, but again, I can't tell if that's my imagination. Yeah, but I removed pine nuts from her life a long time ago, and it made it better. She was still plucking, but just not as intensely. And then I reintroduced them again, and the plucking got so much worse again. So I don't know if there's some sort of allergy involved. I know that pine nuts can be an allergen for some birds. I know
I didn't know that.
Yeah, you would just never believe that nuts would be an allergen for birds. But yeah. Another friend of mine has a bird that plucks, and he removed pine nuts from his bird's diet, and the plucking stopped. So, it could be diet related.
Maybe it's something that's bothering them. Like, we don't even know what kind of reaction they're having when they're having an allergy. Like, we know in humans, and allergies can be anaphylactic, or you can get rashes and things like that.
Yeah.
We don't know what they're feeling, and they can't really tell us.
Yeah.
So they just resort to plucking because they're feeling something and they're frustrated.
And it's the only way that they know how to physically express that discomfort is by attacking the areas that hurt or itch or burn or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And it's I've spent so much time monitoring the environment as well. For example, when Shelby's calm and relaxed, she plucks only down feathers. But when she's stressed and anxious, she plucks out pin feathers, so brand new coloured feathers. So it's like she picks different feathers for different environments. So, or if I fly her too often, she plucks worse if she's flown too much. Yeah. So then you think, oh, is it pain related? So, oh God, it's so complex. It's so complex. I get so many messages constantly every day saying, my bird plucks, what do I do? And I'm like, God, if I knew all of the answers, I'd be in such a much better place myself with my own bird. But yeah, I mean, the first thing is always vet checks, and then work on the environment from there.
Yeah, that's interesting. And when she's pinning the pin feathers, does she ever bleed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sometimes she'll leave like a hole, like an actual round bloody hole.
Oh,
it's
my
horrible.
Gosh.
Yeah,
oh
it's just
my work. Gosh, that's so heartbreaking.
And she makes the noise, like she'll pull it out in front of me and she like screams in pain. So it's not comfortable with her. But then obviously when you do that, when you pull out a feather, when you cause yourself pain, there's that rush of endorphins. So, and that's what turns a sort of medical related plucking issue into a long-term habit, is that reliance on the rush of endorphins and that feel good feeling you get afterwards, even though it sounds counterintuitive. But yeah, that's how a problem starts off as something that probably could be dealt with and turns into something that is just impossible to ever deal with again, which is I think probably the case for Sammy. Like, she'll probably always pluck. I don't think I'll ever be able to reverse that. I'll try, but yeah, I think she'll always pluck.
Yeah. And with the down feathers, where are a pair, like for anybody that's listening, where are their down feathers located?
So the down feathers are the grey fluffy under feathers that sort of coat the entire body under the colour. And so when you brush a bird's feathers the wrong way, you'll see all of this grey fluff underneath. Shelby has none of that. She has no down feathers at all. So it's just those coloured feathers on top. I just don't understand. She must be freezing when she's outside.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. Like, do you notice that she's cold, or like, does she shiver when you guys are outside or free flying, especially in the colder months?
Yeah, she does. She's always shivering. She always looks cold. And I think, well, if you didn't pluck, you probably wouldn't be freezing to death.
Oh my gosh. Have you ever thought about, I've seen these like sweaters or like, you know, these vests that people put on their birds. Mm-hmm. Have you ever thought about, or what are your thoughts on those?
Yeah, I mean, if they work, the only problem is things like that will deal with the plucking in the immediate, but it doesn't deal with the cause of the plucking. So if your bird has, I mean, some birds pluck through arthritis. So if your bird's plucking joints because they've got arthritis and inflammation and pain, the collars and the jackets might stop that for the time being because they can't physically access those locations. But as soon as you remove that jacket, it's just going to start again. So I think if you're using a collar or a jacket and at the same time trying to discover the cause behind the plucking, then it's great. But if you're trying to use a jacket or a collar as the one and only way of stopping plucking, then you're probably not, it's just not going to work, I don't think. And it's certainly for us.
Well, since we're talking about down feathers, actually, before I get into the next question, I wanted you to let everybody know how they can find you on social media.
Okay, so you can follow us by typing in Shelby the McCaw onto literally any platform. We are there. We're everywhere on YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook.
Awesome. And so with the down feathers, that brings me to free flight training and weather. And I know that you free flight train your birds. And I wanted to know, if somebody is thinking about free flight training their birds, whether they have small birds or big birds, do you recommend it for both? And what are your tips if somebody is thinking about getting into it?
So there are definitely some species of parrot that are really highly suited to free flight and some that are more challenging. I'd say the best candidates for free flight are always the macaws, and conures are great free flight candidates. And then you have the more challenging like some cockatoo species and African greys. I think when it comes to free flight training, never ever go into it alone or underestimate how much work goes into it. Again, we're dealing with super intelligent animals that are one step ahead of us at all times, and to take a bird outside and hope for the best is never going to work. Again, because we're dealing with the fact that they are prey animals, they're always going to try to escape something that is a threat to them. And if you're taking a bird outside that's never been outside before, everything is a threat. So they're going to keep flying until they get away from where they think danger is. A very well-trained, highly desensitized bird is a better candidate for free flight, and that takes tons of training. And I always recommend getting support from other people that either do it or that train people to train their birds to free fly. I train free flight myself. I have about 5 students at the moment.
That's awesome.
And I'd love to free fly Sammy. I don't know if she'd be a great candidate at the moment. She can't really fly. She just crashes into walls. But free flight doesn't always have to be outside either. If a bird is flighted but only ever experiences flight inside, then that's great. As long as the bird, where it's safe to do so, experiences flight, I think that's the least they deserve from us.
Yeah.
Is the ability to fly. Wing clipping and things like that is such an outdated practice.
Yeah. It should have never even been a practice. Like, birds have wings for a reason. They serve a purpose for them, and they need flight to develop their muscles, for their physical exercise, and just so much more. And wing clipping, I think, just causes a whole bunch of issues. And I know we could probably talk another hour if we got into that.
Oh, I know. And it's so contentious as well. People get so worked up about wing clipping, and those people that agree with it are so, that like, they stand on their heel. And yeah, I mean, for me, there are very few excuses for wing clipping. But yeah, like you say, that's a whole podcast episode in itself.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I've heard that there's birds that need it for medical reasons, and people say that for that reason. Oh, thank you, Mia. but other than that, I think that it just comes with only problems for the bird.
And yeah, I mean, wing clipping a blind bird is probably a suitable situation. But then again, I work with a blind bird at the World Parrot Trust, and he's not clipped and he's completely fine, happy and healthy. So, I mean, it really is bird by bird case.
Yeah.
Some types of illness, injury may mean that clipping is necessary, but really is very few reasons for it.
Yeah. Was that Sammy?
You know, she goes, ugh, like,
I'm like, is something grossing her out?
Looked at my face. She's like, oh, gross. Sammy.
So with the free flight training, do you take them out all year round?
I do. So those of us that free flight in the community, we sort of have an off season, and there isn't a huge amount going on in the free flight world in winter. And that's because it's not fun for the humans either. Like, no one wants to go and stand out in the cold whilst their bird sits in a tree for an hour.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's definitely a quiet season. Winter has less opportunity to fly. And I still try and get out every day. Like, I will on my own take all 3 macaws and my dog out flying. We just got back before this episode from a big fly. So whenever the weather is suitable in the winter, I'll always, always go. But if it's too windy or raining, then those are environments that I wouldn't take them out free flying in.
Yeah. I actually wanted to talk with you a little bit about temperatures, the outdoor temperatures, and what's too cold. So I know if it's too windy, if it's raining, probably if it's snowing, you're not going to take them out. And so this was a request from a listener, and they said, good afternoon. I was wondering if there's anybody you can bring on to speak about taking your bird outside, for one, and two, if you have anyone who is knowledgeable about birds that are acclimated to colder climates. Parrots that are born and raised in colder climates, making them acclimated to colder climates. I live in the Pacific Northwest, where it is typically colder, and I take my bird everywhere. I go even when it's snowing outside. We will go on hikes as long as it's sunny and clear and not dropping any snow or rain. When it's hot in the summertime, anything above 80, my bird actually pants. He gets overheated very easily. The way my vet explained it is that he would have a thicker undercoating of feathers than birds not acclimated to our zone. There's also a guy in the UK whose birds spend time in the aviary outside in the snow. I mostly would just like to have accurate information out there for those of us who do own birds in colder climates. So what is too cold? And is it possible for parrots to be okay in colder climates? And do they grow potentially more down feathers when they are raised in colder climates?
Such a good question. So in my experience, if a bird is gradually introduced to cooler weather, or extremes on either end of the spectrum, they are so incredibly adaptable. And if your bird, if you're taking your bird out and it's freezing cold and your bird is happy, they're not showing any signs of distress, I think it's completely fine. Birds are super, super adaptable. And in the wild in the UK, in London, we have a huge, huge flock of parakeets that thrive. I mean, they are taking over the whole of the south of the country around London. And they live through our horribly cold winters and relatively hot summers without any issue at all. The same in New York. There's a huge flock of wild Quaker parrots that live in New York, and they deal with the extreme cold and extreme hot over there very well. I think exposing birds to extremes should be done slowly and mindfully. It should be done in a way that you're aware of the process and it's done with purpose. You're taking them out and reducing temperatures that they're exposed to slowly over time. But absolutely, birds can be outside and spend time in extremes on either end of the spectrum. Just be aware of the signs that the bird isn't comfortable, like overly shivering, completely fluffed up, refusing to engage, or that sort of freeze state where they sort of sit and don't engage, don't move, don't play, don't talk, those sorts of things. And yeah, you will notice at the other end of the spectrum where it's too hot, birds do pant. And we experience that. I mean, occasionally the UK will get a summer where we have extreme temperatures of heat, and a couple of years ago we had like a 40 degree centigrade day, which I don't think that's happened for like 60-70 years here. And I really saw a difference in my birds. They were open mouth panting constantly because that is an extreme and it's something they're not used to. But if you can in some way control that environment and control their exposure to either end of the spectrum in a slow, purposeful manner, then it's completely fine. And birds will adapt, and they do adapt. And you're right, they do actually grow a thicker undercoat when they spend more time outside in the cold. And I know there's a few birds in the UK that have spent nights out unintentionally outside overnight in the winter, free flyers, and within a few days they have more pin feathers because their bodies are reacting to the fact that they've spent extended periods of time in colder weather, and their feathers will adapt to that, and they'll grow more down feathers just in case it happens again.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
What is your opinion on birds that are kept in like outdoor aviaries all year round, even in the winter when it's snowing?
Personally, it's not something I've done or would do. That is a personal choice. I think if the person, I know of a few people in the UK that do that, that their birds live outside all year round and they're fine. It's just not a choice I would make, but that's because I have the space to keep them indoors throughout the winter, and I don't have the ability to sort of slowly acclimatise them to freezing cold weather. So I prefer to keep them indoors in extremes. They spend a lot of time outdoors, but they just don't live outdoors. But those that make it work, their birds are obviously really well adapted. They've become used to that weather. Their bodies have probably adapted quite well and to those extremes. And I think, again, like if you're always monitoring the behavior, monitoring their house, regular vet checks, then I don't see a major problem with it.
Okay. Just because I know that a lot of people have this mentality where it's like they're tropical birds, they're exotic, they come from warmer climates. And this follower in particular was saying that she gets a lot of pushback from people because her bird goes hiking with her. But, you know, her bird's not living in an outdoor aviary. Some people, you know, do that. I feel like I would be so worried that like they would get sick or they would catch a cold or it's too cold for them. But like you said, they are really adaptable. And I did see that you also did a post where you mentioned that allowing pet parrots to experience snow for short periods can be both enjoyable and beneficial for them. While it may seem unusual, given that many parrot species originate from warmer climates, the experience can provide mental stimulation, physical exercise, and exposure to novel sensory stimuli. It is something different that they can experience, and it's good to know that if you do take your birds out, that doesn't mean that they're going to get sick right away and that they are adaptable. And birds who do spend more time, or parrots that spend more time outside, they grow more of those down feathers to keep them warmer. I also saw actually that the World Parrot Trust did a post about this recently, and they talked about how birds are resilient and they can acclimate to colder temperatures. Although it can be stressful and potentially harmful, it is really crucial to adopt a slow and measured process when introducing your birds to colder climates.
Yeah, that was actually me that did that post for the World Parrot Trust.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that is so awesome. So we asked the perfect person. I knew. I was like, as soon as I got that question, I was like, we're going to ask Carly.
She's the one to know. Yeah, do you know what? I posted that one because the World Parrot Trust, my role at the World Parrot Trust is to share more parrot care information and really educate people that own parrots, because the majority of people that follow the World Parrot Trust probably own them or have an invested interest in parrot care, parrot ownership. And so there are a few controversial topics that need to be covered, and it has to be done carefully and considerately and mindfully from the voice of the World Parrot Trust. And so I shared that post, and oh my God, the feedback, like some of the keyboard warriors that came out and were like, oh my God, it's so bad. It's neglectful. I can't believe the World Parrot Trust is sharing this. And some people are so just emotionally invested into some of these topics. And that was one of the topics. And I panicked at first. I thought, oh my God, I'm meant to be the voice of the World Parrot Trust and I'm causing all of this controversy. But actually, these topics need to be discussed. And some people will take their birds out and let them live outside, having never been outside before, and spend a night in the snow and then die.
Yeah.
So they need to, these posts need to be made, regardless of those that are so stuck in their opinions and very willing to voice those opinions.
Yeah, absolutely. And there was also another thing that you had mentioned, that snow can offer a new texture for parrots to interact with, stimulating their beaks and feet. The sensory engagement is essential for their mental well-being and can prevent boredom-related behaviors. Additionally, exposure to different environmental conditions like snow encourages problem-solving skills as they navigate this unfamiliar terrain. So I thought that that was also interesting, and it reminded me kind of like of kindergarten and kids and toddlers.
Oh my God.
Because they also, you know, they're always playing in sand and snow, and these are like sensory experiences.
Yeah, I was literally about to say, it's like kids, when it's nice and sunny and hot, you go out and you play in the pool. When it's snowing, you get the kids out and you're playing with snowballs. And it is exactly the same. It's just another form of enrichment. It's exposure to new environments and stimuli. And it's really good for their brains. And really, it's just another added thing to their environment.
Yeah.
So it can't do harm in small doses. It just adds to their desensitization process as well.
Yeah. So I think, like, in summary, you don't want to just like, I wouldn't just take Mia out into the Arctic right now, because she would probably die. But if you live somewhere where there are winters and you have harness trained your bird, or they are free flight trained and you want to take them outdoors, then adapting them and doing slow, gradual introductions to that type of weather. And obviously, you know, there has been instances where birds have spent the night outside, but you wouldn't just get a new bird and have them set up in an outdoor aviary and, you know, have a great winter. You don't want to do
that. That's it. Yeah. Just, I always think with birds and bird keeping, just don't ever take risks. If there is a risk that something will go wrong at any particular time, just don't take that risk. I mean, taking them out in super, super hot weather, if the risk there is that they are going to overheat, then just don't do it. It's not worth it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I just, I very much, especially these days, err on the side of caution with birds, especially exposure to new things and taking them outside, because it's just not worth the risk.
Yeah.
Most of the time.
Yeah. Like, I don't know, how cold do the winters get in the UK, especially when we're talking about these people who have these outdoor aviaries and keep their birds outside? Like, I'm from Canada, so I know that it can get like minus 27, minus 35. Yeah. Like, I was just experiencing some minus in the 20s, and I wouldn't want my bird out in that, but I don't know what types of winters.
Not to that extreme, for
okay.
sure. We get sort of like, I guess a super cold spell would be minus 10 maybe at night. In the winter, it's sort of minus 4 to 5, which overnight for a bird, I mean, it's not comfortable. It's not the end of the world for one night for a bird. It really isn't. But yeah, I mean, in the daytime, maybe in the depths of winter, it's sort of 0 degrees in the day and one and two. At the moment, we're in a really mild spell at sort of 12 and 13 degrees. So it's really nice.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah, I know. For January, the 712th, whatever we're at now, is a great temperature. So yeah, I mean, overnight, occasional accidental overnights in the winter in the UK, I don't think is a big deal. Living permanently 24/7 in these temperatures outside, it's just, yeah, it's not a practice I would do. But if people's birds are acclimatized to it and they are adapted to it, then, and they thrive, like you get birds in zoos that live outside, that they big collections of macaws and stuff that live in outside enclosures all year round, and they survive. So it can be done, and it can be done safely.
Do you think that it makes a difference if it's like a big bird like a macaw versus like a small bird like a conure or a budgie or a parrotlet?
I don't know. I think each of their bodies are adapted to their specific size. Their feather and coating is all comparative to their size. So I don't think it makes a huge difference.
Okay. Great. Well, I think that answers that. So let's start to wrap things up, because I've had you for almost 2 hours. So we'll wrap things up so you can enjoy the rest of your day. And before we wrap things up, I wanted to ask you some funny questions. But before I ask those, I wanted you to share, do you have any advice for someone that's considering to get a macaw or an African grey as a pet?
My advice is always do your research. It's always learn as much as you can. You can never learn too much, because the minute that bird comes into your life, there's no turning back. And if you do decide to bring it in and then rehome it again, the impact on that bird's mental health could be long lasting, could be lifelong lasting. So yeah, be really considerate of the intelligence level and care needs of parrots, and do as much research as possible, because what is 1 year of research when you're about to spend 60 years with a bird? It really doesn't. 1 year of just taking your time and really considering the pros and cons is just nothing in comparison to how long that bird will be with you. So just research the living daylights out of parrot care from everywhere you can possibly get information, people, websites, YouTube, everywhere.
I love that. That is the best advice. I love it. Also, in 2023, I saw that you went through a glow up, and I wanted to congratulate you on that and say, you go, girl, keep it up, and you look fabulous.
Oh, amazing. Thank you.
That was around the time where I found your page, and I'm like, I love her.
Who is she?
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it was about time. I needed to sort my life out and my health more than anything.
Oh, I went through the same thing, believe me. Yeah, so I had a little bit of a glow up myself.
Oh, amazing. You look incredible.
Oh, thank you. So do you. Let's do some funny questions. If your parents had a talent show, what unique skills do you think each one of them would showcase?
Sammy's would be her ability to swear at most inappropriate moments. And she also farts, makes fart and burp noises constantly. If I drink, usually she goes. Usually she goes and does like the most man burp you've ever heard. Shelby's would be, I don't know. I think Shelby's would be just her ability to just make people laugh because she's such a clown. Tommy would just melt everyone's hearts because she's so sweet. Loki just looks stunning. So the way he looks would be enough to, get him through a talent show. There's not much going on upstairs with Loki, so there's not a lot else he would successfully be able to get away with.
I love it. And if your parents wrote a book, what do you think the book would be about and what would the title be?
Chaos. And it would be
one
all
word.
About chaos. The book would be torn into shreds. You wouldn't be able to read it. It would be a complete mess. Be covered in bird poo. There would be no book.
There's no book. I love it. Okay. If your parents started a DIY home improvement project, what room or area do you think that they would focus on and what would they do?
Well, Sammy is currently redecorating my living room, actually. She started pulling all the wallpaper off because apparently she doesn't like the color green. And Shelby doesn't like the blinds, so she's currently trying to replace those one line at a time. So, yeah, I think they'd go to work on the living room. If I left them alone in this room for 2 minutes, I wouldn't have a TV. There'd be no wallpaper on the walls. The blinds would be down on the floor and the sofa would have about 1,000 holes in it. So...
So they really take this DIY improvement, home improvement seriously.
Yeah, they are very, very invested in ensuring that I'm constantly changing up my environment.
Yeah, and spending loads of money on it.
Yes, they want me to be poor forever.
If your parents hosted a talk show, who would be their ideal celebrity guest?
Oh, probably Jack Sparrow. Nothing to do with the fact that I adore him. But yeah, I think who else would parrots want on their talk show?
Yeah, but a pirate and the best one of them all.
That's it. Yeah.
I love it. So Johnny Depp, we're calling you over.
Yes.
Now, I know as parents, we usually have a million nicknames for our birds and our pets. Mm-hmm. So what are the funniest nicknames that you have for each of your birds?
So Shelby, I've always called Shelby, Shelby Shoes. So I call her Shelby Shoes or Shelby. Tommy, what do we call? Oh, Thomasina Ballerina. Because Tommy's short for Thomasina, she's female. So we call her Thomasina Ballerina. Loki, I call Pokey. and Sammy, I always say Sammy's name in a weird voice because she says her own name a lot. That's one of the main things she says. She goes, Sammy. So I always go up to her and I'm like, Sammy.
This stupid voice.
So yeah, that's Sammy's nickname is just Sammy.
I just heard Sammy doing some lasers over there.
Oh, yeah. That's her playing noise. She does that when.
I actually, Mia can say one word and it's literally her name and she says it the same way that I say it because I always say her name in like this cute voice where I'm like, Mia, Mia, Mia. So now she literally says, Mia, Mia. Oh, and here she is. She had left me and here she popped up because she heard.
You called? Oh, she's, how old is she?
She will be 3 this May.
Oh, look.
So she's just a little baby, but she's going to be a baby forever.
Yeah. Oh, they are babies. They're forever toddlers.
Yeah, forever babies.
Mm-hmm. No, she's adorable.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining me for this podcast episode. It was so much fun and it was so informative. And I'm sure that everybody is going to love it.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's such an honor.
Thanks so much for tuning in to the Parrot Podcast. I'm your host, Sandra from Poodles and Parrots. I hope that you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. I definitely learned some new things from Carly, and I had no idea that birds could acclimate so well to colder temperatures, amongst other things. It was so awesome to meet Sammy and all of her macaws, Shelby, Tommy, and Loki. And we will see you guys in the next episode. Have a awesome day. Oh, and one more thing. This podcast is presented solely for educational and entertainment purposes. I am not a licensed avian vet, behaviorist, or professional expert in parrots. The information provided is not intended as a substitute for professional advice from a qualified avian vet, trainer, or behaviorist. Consult with a specialist for personalized guidance on your specific situation.